Now, Northwestern University fired its head football coach, Pat Fitzgerald, last week after reporting from the student newspaper there revealed further details about a hazing culture on the football team. Multiple former players reported forced participation in degrading sexualized acts that they say were well known within the program. Some of that hazing reportedly took place at a team training facility in Kenosha. Here in Wisconsin, a hazing and bullying scandal was reported on the Middleton High School football team last year that led to the resignation of their head coach. Those are just two of the latest examples in a long history of hazing controversies on sports teams, school settings, fraternities and sororities, the military, even some workplaces. These practices can cause significant mental and physical harm, even death for the victims. Groups across the country are working to stop that behavior. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Why do you think groups engage in hazing? What kind of things do you think we can do to prevent it in the first place? Have you ever witnessed or been part of one of these hazing incidents? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Elizabeth Allen is a professor of higher education at the University of Maine. She was the principal investigator for the National Study of Student Hazing, is the director of the National Hazing Prevention Consortium, which currently includes the University of Wisconsin. Elizabeth, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for inviting me. Good to be here.
We may have different thoughts or images pop into our heads when we think of hazing. Can you give us a standard definition that you work with for what qualifies as hazing?
Sure. The definition that we use and that's commonly accepted is that hazing is any activity that is expected of someone joining or maintaining membership in a group that endangers them, that humiliates, degrades, abuses, or endangers them, regardless of a person's willingness to participate. And what we like to point out with that definition is that there are three key components. So first is understanding that hazing involves that group context, that joining or maintaining membership. That secondly, it involves specific types of abusive behavior and or specific types of behavior that would be deemed abusive or potentially abusive. And thirdly, that it can happen regardless of a person's willingness to participate, which is really important because sometimes people think, well, it wasn't hazing because we gave them the choice of whether or not to do it. But that doesn't take into account that coercive environment that can be created in hazing situations.
How common is hazing, at least as far as we can tell, based on what is reported?
So based on the research that's been done, as you mentioned in the introduction, I was the principal investigator of a national study of college students and who reported on their experiences and perceptions related to hazing. And there we found that 55% of students who belong to some kind of club, organization, or team had experienced hazing. And we also asked them about their experiences in high school, and 47% had experienced hazing in high school. And other studies, another study, national study that was focused on high school hazing specifically found 48%. And so we know we've done some more recent data collection and analysis. The national study I spoke about involved more than 11,000 students. The more recent data, we don't have as many students or as many institutions, but we have found that the rates are lower, roughly between 25 and 30%, but those are on campuses that have implemented prevention programs.
Let's talk about prevention. Let's just stick with the college sports example. It's in the news, easy thing to talk about, I think. How can, say, a college athletic program, first of all, create a culture where hazing is seen as unacceptable?
Yeah, that is such an important question, and one that we've really been focusing on so much in recent years is really collecting data that will help to guide effective prevention. And you mentioned the University of Wisconsin is in the Hazing Prevention Consortium, so they are part of that effort because we're not only working with them to provide assistance and coaching around hazing prevention, but also collecting data in the process. So to your question, what can an athletic department do? There's a lot that an athletic department can do, or a coach can do, or a team captain can do. And it doesn't boil down to one thing, but it's many things that can contribute to creating a healthier team environment or group culture where hazing is far less likely to occur. We have several resources on the Stop Hazing website that provide guidance around this, but it really boils down to positive, like, leadership and understand and trying to shift the norms that may have been in place that would contribute to a hazing culture. So if there were hazing traditions in the past, or there's a really rigid hierarchy where the expectations are that the newcomers do a lot of work of the group and the veterans don't need to do anything or feel they've paid their dues. Those are some dynamics that can be disrupted to help create a healthier culture where hazing is less likely to occur. And of course, it really is about how do you, you know, what are you trying to accomplish? If you're trying to accomplish building cohesion in a group, there are so many more healthy ways to do that than hazing. And so it's just a matter of figuring out and building the skills for how to shift away from hazing traditions and incorporate positive, healthy traditions that will accomplish some of the same goals that students are striving for.
Talking to Elizabeth Allen with the University of Maine, director of the National Hazing Prevention Consortium, looking at hazing in athletics and beyond after the firing of the head coach at Northwestern. Hazing comes to the Big Ten. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have thoughts on that Northwestern story, ideas on how to prevent hazing in any organization, join in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. John is with us in Brown Deer. John, hi.
Yes, good afternoon, and thank you for accepting my call. I played football at Northwestern from the years 1963 to 1967, and there was nothing that ever approached something like that occurred at Northwestern at this time. There was never any hazing, never any type of ritual that the football players were required to pass in order to be accepted. You were accepted as a football player and you earned your bones on the football field, not by dancing around in the shower. And Alex Agassi and Errol Parseghian never would have tolerated this. They would have anyone that would just was near it, that even was tainted by it, would lose a scholarship and be banned from or kicked off the football team.
John, I got to ask, having been part of this tradition of Northwestern football, as you see the stories and you're pointing toward the forced participation in nudity and sexualized acts of a degrading nature, is how players describe it. I mean, what does that make you think about what's become of this program you were part of?
Well, I think it's being tolerated by the coaches or the supervisors of the team. They must know about it. If something like that would have happened in my day, Alex Agassi or Errol Parseghian would have known about it. I mean, they kept strict watch and discipline on their football teams. There was nothing like this ever could have occurred. I was taken aback by this having occurred at Northwestern. I sort of lost a little bit of pride of having played there at that school.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, John, but thank you so much for sharing that experience. Elizabeth, John pointing toward what he sees as strong leadership in his day, wouldn't have tolerated this kind of thing.
Absolutely. And I'm so appreciative of the call, because that is a really key aspect of prevention, is that visible leadership. Whether it's, like I said, from the team captain, the coaches, it's all of them matter. The university president, and in between, it's leaders really being clear about the expectations for what is appropriate behavior and what is absolutely unacceptable. And so we found in our research that students report that coaches are often, or they believe coaches are frequently aware of the hazing that's happening. And it's a major problem for a number of reasons, but obviously, but also because students then feel like they are more reluctant to come forward and share their concerns because they feel that the coach knows about it, and maybe they may, the coach might not be directly involved, but isn't doing anything to prevent it or make a statement about it. And so it contributes to normalizing the behavior.
Thanks a lot for that call. And the coach Fitzgerald from Northwestern, now former coach, in a statement says, quote, "I had no knowledge whatsoever of any form of hazing," end quote. He says the investigation there confirmed that. If that's true, and let's take it away from the Northwestern case, hazing's happening. The coach really didn't know about it. Is there still, in your mind, some responsibility on the coach for not knowing about it, for not creating a culture where hazing doesn't happen?
I do feel that coaches are responsible for creating a culture. And I know that many are working to do that. I've met many of them who are really proactive in creating a team culture where everyone feels respected, and where, people are putting their energy towards the goal of being a team member and winning matches and games and so forth, and not towards the stress of being hazed or abusing others. So, yeah, I think it's absolutely a responsibility of the coach to be aware that hazing is a possibility, that there's potential that it could be happening, and to do whatever they can to set a tone. And again, as I mentioned before, expectations. In addition to setting a tone and expectations for the kind of behavior, it's really helpful to also be providing resources for students to know where they should go, being open to, having students report to them if they have concerns. So, keeping those lines of communication open and being transparent about expectations and related to hazing is key.
Talking to University of Maine higher education professor Elizabeth Allen, an expert on hazing, looking at hazing in the news in the Big Ten at Northwestern University and how to prevent it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about hazing, how it happens, why it happens? What efforts would you like to see taken to prevent hazing? Have you encountered it in your own career, athletic or otherwise? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Elizabeth Allen, professor of higher education at the University of Maine, director of the National Hazing Prevention Consortium, with us today to talk about the problems caused by hazing in athletic departments and elsewhere after a prominent scandal on the Northwestern University football team led to the firing of the coach there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered hazing in your life, or has maybe your kid? What questions do you have about ways to prevent it in the first place, or maybe you have some ideas? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Elizabeth, you mentioned positive alternatives to hazing. Now, we humans have a long tradition of, initiation rituals to build solidarity among a group. What would be a better way to do this, say, on a football team, that doesn't involve hazing?
Yeah, that is a great question. And I'd like to mention a resource that we have if listeners are interested in hearing more. It's a 17-minute documentary style film called We Don't Haze. It's you can download it from our website, stophazing.org. But in it features a number of athletes from different colleges and universities across the country where they talk about alternatives and alternatives to hazing to help build solidarity and have positive initiations and traditions. Some of the things would be, for example, having a team meal together, going on a hike together or some kind of outing, doing a service project together. But really, I think it's super important to identify what the goals are. And once those goals are identified, make sure that those are in alignment with the values of the team and the organization. And this is where coaches and advisors can be super helpful. And then, you know, go from there. I mean, if the goal is to have a good time together and get to know each other, then why not all get together and go to cheer on another team on campus and sit together and, or as I mentioned, a team meal or some other activity that doesn't involve risking anyone's physical or emotional health. There are many, many different options.
How about reporting hazing? Because you could picture, you know, that new member of a team, say a high school or a college team, they experience a negative, I guess it's inherently negative, a hazing experience, but they don't want to, you know, have their whole team turn against them by reporting. They might even worry, you know, how's the coach going to react? Are they cool with this hazing thing in the first place? What do institutions do to provide an outlet to make sure that students can report it when it happens?
Yeah, so many institutions, because of that fear that so many folks have for coming forward, many have instituted anonymous reporting mechanisms. Sometimes there will be a hotline, and, you know, other times it's a way that to file a report without having to provide your name that would be shared. Certainly, in many cases, confidentiality can be assured, but not always. It just depends on what the reporting party would like to see happen. So yeah, there are ways. I encourage anyone who has a report to share to look into the different options, because those options for anonymous reporting do exist in many instances. And I would say if that is not available, to inquire of a campus official or a school official, a trusted administrator, about what the options are for reporting, and then go from there. Often we find in our research that students report hazing to their friends and family members far more regularly, far more often than they do to a campus or school official. And often that's because they don't know where to report or who to report to. Sometimes they're not aware a policy exists. But, you know, I think there's also that fear. And so a lot of campus professionals and school administrators are working to really break down the barriers. And so there's been a lot of change recently to support folks in coming forward.
I wonder about kind of the self-perpetuating nature of hazing, where, say, in a fraternal organization or a college sports team, you're the first-year student, you go through it, and then by the time you're senior, hey, I went through it, I survived, it's tradition, I'm going to pass it on to this next generation, and we're going to keep it quiet. We're going to try to keep the authorities from discovering it. How do you break that self-perpetuating cycle?
Absolutely. I think that's a huge challenge with hazing. But what we found is that there are folks within who may have endured hazing and have stuck with the organization that really don't support it and would like to see a change. Part of the problem is that they often feel like they're the only ones who feels that way. And so it's really helpful to break down that misconception. And we have our research works to do that, to correct misperceived norms. But I think, you know, bottom line, I think that it just takes courage And if you can find the courage to speak out, there are others who will likely step forward with you and will want to see the change. That's what I hear over and over again from so many people who have experienced hazing and don't want to see it happen again to somebody else.
Here's another misconception, and this is one of mine, I'll say, and based on our caller earlier, I would think that hazing is an old school, back in the day kind of thing, and maybe it pops up here and there, but it's mostly on the way out. Well, hearing from our caller earlier, he saw the opposite happen. It got worse since he was in school in the 60s. Hazing is still a problem. It sounds like, Elizabeth, that's sadly alive and well.
Yes, it is sadly alive and well. I think more than most, people in the general public recognize or realize. And so we're working super hard to continue to get the word out that this is something that folks need to be aware of and know what the signs might be and how to help prevent it. And know where to go to report it if they do see it, or if they're a bystander, or if someone shares information with them about hazing. So, yeah, there's still a lot of work to be done. The good news is that there is much more research and resources out there for prevention than we've ever had before. We still need a lot more, but we're at least getting a foothold.
Elizabeth, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Elizabeth Allen with the University of Maine, principal investigator for the National Study of Student Hazing, currently directing the National Hazing Prevention Consortium. She mentioned resources on hazing. Her organization has those resources online, Hazing Prevention, Hazing Alternatives. Find those online at stophazing.org. That's stophazing.org. We'll get a link up at wpr.org/centraltime as well.